This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Happening right now in North Dakota, armed soldiers and police are trying to disperse protesters at the site of an oil pipeline project. This is the Dakota Access Pipeline you've heard about. It would run through areas the Standing Rock Sioux tribe says are sacred, and it would go under the river where the tribe gets its water. Thousands of people, Native and non-Native Americans, have come to North Dakota to protest the project. Protesters have refused to leave what is legally private land. They've blocked the highway, and now the soldiers and police, dressed in riot gear, are telling protesters over a loudspeaker to move out. Seattle Times reporter Linda Mapes is there, and I spoke to her about an hour ago as police were confronting the protesters.
I see police cars, helicopters, planes, a very large force marshaled on the hill just beyond where the protesters are camped. Instead of leaving, many, many, many more people are coming. Men, women, children, elders. They're praying, they're singing, they're burning sage. Nobody's leaving. And in the distance, I see armored personnel carriers. I see bulldozers. I see lots and lots of squad cars with flashing lights. I see a helicopter just about to land. So, very tense situation, but people here seem very determined not to leave.
We can hear the singing and chanting behind you, Linda. So can you tell yet whether all this, the cars, the helicopters, the personnel carriers, whether police are about to start hauling people away off this private land, this disputed land?
It's hard to say when that's going to happen. They've given a lot of warnings by megaphone. They've shouted to the people here that you need to disperse, you need to leave now, or you will be arrested under North Dakota law. No one will hurt you. You need to walk south to the main camp. You can stay there as long as you want, but you must leave now. That's been repeated many, many times. And instead, what people have done is formed prayer circles, locked arms, and vowed to stay. It's very evocative, you know, Indian people on horseback facing down law enforcement. That's been going on for 150 years, and people here feel that very deeply. Talking to people in camp yesterday, they said they have had a lot of visions and a lot of dreams about this ending badly, violently, but they feel determined to stay.
Yes, Linda Mapes with the Seattle Times is your eyes right now at this, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe land or disputed land around this pipeline. And I can hear that this is police calling to disperse?
Actually, no. That is one of the members of the protesters. They're telling people to stay on the fog lines. Those are the white stripes on the sides of roads, telling them they need to stand there in a line, and hundreds of people have amassed there. The idea is safety in numbers. Don't let yourself be picked off so you can be arrested if you're standing alone. Stand together, lock arms. Don't leave. I see black smoke in the distance. Someone has started burning tires. They've formed a blockade. This is the main north-south road in North Dakota. It's 1806, and it's been shut down now by the protesters. Lots and lots of black smoke rising. I haven't seen that before.
Obviously, this is happening. We don't know what's going to happen moment to moment. What are the options here, Linda? What could happen?
Well, the most likely thing that's going to happen is that the sheriff's deputies and law enforcement, who have arrived from many states to assist them, are going to move in on the demonstrators and begin to arrest them one after another. That's the most likely outcome because nobody's leaving and they've said they're coming. So it's just a question of when they decide to make their move.
And I don't want to exaggerate the threat of violence here, Linda. You were telling us that there are tribal members and their supporters chanting songs of death, that they're very aware of the history of violence that comes before all of this.
That's very true. And you see people wearing T-shirts with signs that say, honor the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851. You see bumper stickers on cars that say American Indian Movement, remember Wounded Knee. I mean, it's different if you're Indian. You've been through this. Your ancestors have been through this. There's a kind of, there's a legacy that's very real. There's a history that's very real. And a lot of people feel like they're doing what they have to do, the same thing their people have always done, to defend their land, to defend their way of life. And it's an interesting crowd. You know, it's mostly Indian people. They're from nations all over the country. Many people have said this is the largest gathering of Indian nations in 150 years. Anyone can remember.
Is there a peaceful possible outcome in this? Could the pipeline builders, the Energy Transfer Partners Company, do they have any other options to go a different way with this project?
Oh, sure. I mean, they can always make a change. You know, they can always reroute. I mean, the pipeline was originally routed north of Bismarck, but they decided to bring it down here, 10 miles from the Standing Rock Reservation, because of concerns of drinking water up in the state capital to protect the wells up there. So what did they do? They brought it down here. And, you know, the developer, you know, they did a lot of work to try to make this thing happen. They thought about all kinds of risks. You know, you look at their environmental documents and so forth, and they thought about stuck pipes. They thought about rocks in the ground. They thought about all sorts of issues, but they didn't think of 150 years of history. They're moving in, and I may have to move back a little bit. I can't get arrested. That's not the plan. I can't cover the if I get arrested, so I'm paying attention to that. Hay bales and tires are starting to burn, and the sheriff's helicopter is circling low, and there's a sense that they're moving in soon.
That was Seattle Times environment reporter Linda Mapes talking with me about an hour ago on the scene in North Dakota, where law enforcement were trying to disperse protesters from legally private land. Now, Associated Press is reporting that the pipeline protesters have retreated from a direct confrontation and that law enforcement officers and soldiers are advancing to force them away from a camp on that land in the path of the pipeline's construction. About 200 protesters are listening to elders speak, burning sage and praying while law officers approach that camp. We will continue to get you updates on the standoff through the day here on KUOW and on our website, KUOW.org. Thank you for tuning in to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Here's a question for you. When was the last time a Republican won the presidential vote in Washington State? The answer? Ronald Reagan, 1984. In local elections, though, Republicans have been more successful. They won control of the state Senate in 2013, and this year the party hoped to take over the state House. That was before Donald Trump. KUOW's Deborah Wong reports on the possible Trump effect in Washington State.
It's not hard to see what local Republicans are up against this year when you go door to door in the suburbs east of Lake Washington.
Hi, I'm Paul Graves. I'm running for state representative.
Paul Graves is a 34-year-old lawyer who's running for an open house seat in the 5th Legislative District in eastern King County. He says he's knocked on close to 19,000 doors, including Jackie Treadwell's in Maple Valley.
Are you Democrat or Republican?
Republican, and a reasonable one.
Okay.
Yeah.
While Graves introduces himself as a reasonable Republican, Treadwell says she's just not sure about the Republican Party these days.
I used to be Republican. I still kind of am, but I don't like Trump.
Yeah, well, it's one of those years. You got a believer in me then.
Graves says he doesn't like Trump either, especially after Trump attacked John McCain for being captured in Vietnam and after Trump's crude comments about women.
Misogyny is just such a wrong thing. Like, to have somebody say those kind of things about women is just so wrong. Character still matters, and that's a lack of character. And so I can't give my support.
In any other presidential year, denouncing the person at the top of the ticket would probably be considered disloyal, but not this year. By all indications, Trump is trailing significantly in Washington State. The latest Elway poll shows Trump with only 31% support, compared with Hillary Clinton's 48%. Many Republican candidates have denounced Trump. They include Chris Vance, who's running for U.S. Senate, and Bill Bryant, who's running for governor. Trump has even become an issue in the state treasurer's race, which features two Republicans, Michael Waite and Duane Davidson. Davidson has declined to give his opinion on Trump, saying he doesn't want to politicize the state treasurer's race. Waite says he will not support Trump, but he's frustrated that it's even an issue.
It's distracting from what we already realize is a very limited information race, and to spend any time outside of just talking about the fact that I can add tremendous value in the treasurer's office detracts from our potential for change.
So the question that both Democrats and Republicans are asking is, will there be a Trump effect? And how much will Trump's unpopularity affect state and local Republican candidates? If you ask Republicans, they're likely to say, not much. Rob McKenna is a former attorney general who ran unsuccessfully for governor in 2012. McKenna says, especially in suburban districts, voters are used to splitting their ticket, voting Democrat at the top for president and Senate, and Republican in local races.
This is a state of notoriously independent voters where people routinely split their ticket and are proud of saying, I voted for people in the other party. I know a lot of Republicans and Democrats who are proud of saying that there's at least one Democrat or Republican that they regularly vote for.
But Democratic pollsters say all indications are that this is going to be a very tough year for Republicans up and down the ticket. Ben Anderstone is a political consultant with the group Progressive Strategies Northwest. He specializes in figuring out voter sentiment. He says Trump has deeply tarnished the Republican brand.
Republican candidates on the state level are really on the defensive, having to spend a lot of time distancing themselves from Trump and the national Republican brand. And being on the defensive is never a good position in politics.
Anderstone says Republicans in this part of the state typically do a good job drawing support from Democratic-leaning voters. They've tended to focus on economic issues, making the case that Republicans are better qualified to keep tabs on your pocketbook. But this year, Anderstone says, that's going to be a harder sell for Republicans.
You know, the most well-trained athlete is going to have trouble when the incline goes up. And that's the situation the Republicans are facing this year in Washington.
According to the Elway poll, 48% of voters say they're likely to vote for Democrats in races for state legislature versus 36% for Republicans. And that's welcome news for Democratic candidates like Darcy Berner. She runs a button-making business in Carnation.
We have all kinds of different tops with different artists, different designs.
Berner has run three times unsuccessfully for Congress, and this year she's battling Paul Graves for that open state House seat. She says voters she's met in the district are pretty united in their dislike of Trump.
People are pretty upset. Occasionally, I will run into somebody who's a fervent Trump supporter, but honestly, it's pretty rare.
Berner says women in particular are turning away not just from Trump, but from the Republican Party in general. And she believes that will help the Democratic Party across the board.
It's clearly going to be a wave year. I think the question at the moment is it a wave year or is it a tsunami year?
But local Republicans say success at the polls will come down to who's working hardest to reach voters. And they're trying to convince them not to worry so much about the presidential race. Here's Paul Graves again on Jackie Treadwell's porch.
You know, the schools your kids go to and your grandkids go to, the roads you drive on, the business climate in this state, that all happens in Olympia, not in D.C. And so I think especially if you're frustrated with your choices for president, it's worth focusing on these races.
And success may also be about lowering expectations. Earlier in the year, Republicans talked a lot about taking control of the state House from the Democrats. Now Republicans are saying they're hoping for a tie.
Good talking to you.
In Maple Valley, I'm Deborah Wong, KUOW News.
This is KUOW. If you recognize this song, you're probably a fan of the 90s TV show Twin Peaks. The weird, mysterious cult classic was set here in Washington around North Bend, and next year the show will return to the Northwest. After 25 years off the air, Showtime is making 9 new episodes. The co-creator of Twin Peaks, Mark Frost, has a new book about the series called The Secret Lives of Twin Peaks. Frost told Jeannie Yandel why they first decided to set the show in the Northwest.
Number one, the Northwest hadn't really been depicted a lot in popular culture at that point. David Lynch had spent a good portion of his childhood living in that part of the world. We picked it because we thought it was appropriate tonally and thematically to the material that we were working with. And when we found the locations that we'd been looking for, we looked all over the Seattle area. And then that, I think it was the last day we were on our scout, we drove into the Snoqualmie Valley, and there it was. There was the old mill, there was the diner, there was the movie theater. It was almost as if it had been sitting there waiting for us. It was a lot of the locations that we'd put on paper were exactly as we'd described. It was really spooky. And we knew we'd found our town when we drove in. they've now had a kind of tourist boom in that area, because that to the world is now Twin Peaks more than it is Snoqualmie or North Bend in a lot of cases.
Well, you got to come back to Washington State to film part of the new series. What was it like being back here after 25 years?
It was haunting, honestly. Most of us hadn't been back to the Snoqualmie Valley since we shot the pilot in 1989, 1990. And many of us hadn't seen each other, the cast and crew, and we had some of the original crew come back as well. So it was really a once-in-a-lifetime experience of going back to this place that we had really known quite intensely when making the pilot. And obviously, the place had lived on in people's imagination as this fictional town that they had a lot invested in. So to go back to those original locations meant many or most of them were still intact. And to be back with this same group of people, it was like a time machine and a glorious kind of college reunion at the same time. Because when you go through something as intense as that original run of the show was with people, you bond with them in a way that's really hard to duplicate.
At the end of the second season in 1991, one of the characters on Twin Peaks says she'll be back in 25 years. I mean, was this your plan to come back 25 years later?
Accidentally. I mean, we were planning to come back in 4 months. You know, we thought we were going to have a third season. So we did a lot of work, and a lot of storylines were laid out in relation to that. So some of the spade work had been done when we decided to bring it back, but also the discovery that that line was there made it a whole lot easier to justify the long wait or the long gap. I don't know that there's any precedent for a kind of continuing narrative like this to take a quarter century break, but, you know, why not try it? So that's what we did.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the universe that was created with Twin Peaks in the first place, that kind of mysterious, haunting feeling that was in the show that you've described kind of making the show, sort of the spookiness of finding a place that fit with what you imagined and the fact that it hasn't really changed much in a quarter of a century when you went back. Will that feeling, that sort of, I guess, insular, mysterious feeling continue with this new series?
Yeah, I mean, we're still talking about the same place. So there was a timelessness to the place. I mean, everybody commented on that at the time, that it seemed like it could have taken place in almost any decade. And it's always been my experience that when you go to smaller towns around the country, you're not going to see the bright, flashy things that come straight off the showroom floor in big cities that you're going to see when you go into those homes or those communities. You're going to find that the town has largely stayed the same over time. And I happen to think that the passage of time is one of the great themes in all of literature or drama, because we're all wrapped up in it. We're caught in it. We're in this slipstream of time that's carried us in our lives to this point, and we know where it's headed. So to watch characters go through that is a universal experience that I think really anybody can relate to.
What was it like creating that timeline for characters, seeing what had happened to them in 25 years? I mean, as you said, when we first started talking, initially you were all thinking about 4 months and then coming back. That's a huge break.
Yeah, and that was the challenge. I can't say too much about it because I don't want to give anything away about where we're headed. But the journey I took, having been sort of unstuck in time with the quarter century, I went in the opposite direction. I went back in time to find the origins of all these people and the kind of mysterious influences that formed the feelings that people got from the series in the first place. And in doing so, you know, you're able to kind of create a context larger than the one that the show itself was able to provide you, because the format of the written word is different and more expansive than what you can see on television. You can stop and think and ruminate and ponder what these things might have been. So the great joy for me in going back in time was finding out where all these things began and watching as the people that you knew in the show slowly start to come on stage with the passage of time, and you meet them as younger people and you take them through the course of their lives. That was a real joy creatively for me, and that was the appeal to me of doing the book.
I have to ask, Mark, you're talking about traveling back in time to tell origin stories for some of these characters and why they are who they are, and jumping 25 years forward to see where they are now. What is your favorite thing about the universe that you created with Twin Peaks?
Well, there's a thematic through line that kind of carries you through the book, and it's this idea of the role of mystery in human life that, for centuries, people just used religion to deal with that part of existence. They posited that there were supernatural beings or a being that was responsible for creation. And we're now living in a universe that's in many ways moved beyond that concept. And we're forced to confront, what are we doing here? You know, are we just people revolving around a sun on this rock in space and it's a remorseless and different universe? Or is there meaning to it? Are we here for a reason? Mysteries, or in the Joseph Campbell sense of the word, mythology, has been what's always provided us with the sense that this all counts for something, and it invests life in its smallest and largest ways with things that provide meaning to us and richness and nurturing experiences, so that life is not just simply an endless string of consumer purchases, you know, that there's a richness to our inner life that I think we're all kind of grasping toward and hoping for. And that is one of the things I wanted to try to dive into with the book. What are the mysteries that sustain us and give us a sense of meaning that we can cling to, as opposed to secrets, which tend to be things that people use to withhold power and to wield it over others? And that dynamic tension between those two philosophies, I think, lies at the heart of what that region and this fictional town is all about, but also kind of the story of what our country is all about.
That feels like a surprisingly timely thing to say, given that we're staring at this presidential election right now. It's both timeless and very timely.
Well, these are questions that we best ask ourselves right now, because we're on a precipice of something here. You know, is life just about acquisition and power and dominance and a zero-sum game where there can only be winners and losers? Or is this something that we're supposed to share? Is this something that we're supposed to all participate in and derive benefit from? It's two different ways of living. It's two different cultural approaches to a civilized world. And I really like to think and hope that we lean toward the latter. And I guess in a couple of weeks, we're going to have a pretty big referendum on that subject.
I'm curious to know what you're hoping new viewers will find in that tension you just described. What do you hope that they see in this, I guess, new chapter of this mythology you're talking about?
Well, it gets to the importance of narrative in people's lives, that there's a central part that narrative plays in the way we construct our own life story, the life story of our families and communities. And it's largely the way in which we both mark time and derive meaning by going through this lifespan that's, you know, the steps of which are pretty prescribed. It's the seven ages of humankind, as Shakespeare nailed it four centuries ago. So having had this long passage of time in the middle, that's automatically what the show is about. It's, to me, the greatest works of art are things that deal with the fact that we all age and die. And that gives urgency to living. And hopefully it gives you an impetus to live in the moment. I think that's what the best art reminds us of what we should do. It's something that I hope people will get from the show. That's more sort of in the deep background. I never try to direct people toward what they should get out of it. It's really up to them. But it's a joy to see a whole new generation come on board.
Mark Frost, co-creator of the iconic 90s television show Twin Peaks. His new book is The Secret Lives of Twin Peaks. And Mark is in Seattle this weekend. He's doing an event at the Elliott Bay Bookstore Saturday evening, 7 o'clock. Okay, now from Washington's Twin Peaks out to our plains. It is winter wheat planting time in eastern Washington. We are the biggest, fourth biggest wheat producing state in America. But KUOW's Anna King tells us the spring wheat harvest we just had has turned up a weird and troubling problem.
We're at the USDA's Western Wheat Quality Lab here at Washington State University in Pullman.
This is where we do our baking of cakes, cookies, bread, pancakes, noodles, and pasta.
That's Alicia Kishonis. She's a federal research biologist. All this good-smelling baking is purely for science. It's composted after. This year, they'll make 4,500 batches of stuff testing Northwest wheat quality. Mostly, a lot of Japanese sponge cakes and noodles. Makes sense, since the Philippines, Japan, and other Asian countries are our best wheat customers. This year, the scientists are doing hundreds of extra tests. Nearly half of the soft white wheat tested so far has problems. Asian sponge cake is supposed to be eggy, warm, and fluffy, but much of this year's wheat is making stuff that's
dense, they're small, and they start to turn more from a light and airy sponge cake into something that more resembles a pound cake that's dense and thick.
And that won't cut it in Japan.
No, that is highly unacceptable.
So what gives? This big problem is called low falling number. Basically, it means there is an enzyme formed in a kernel of wheat that's eaten away at the starch.
Unfortunately, one kernel with low falling number can bring down a much larger batch of wheat, which is why this is such a problem.
Low falling number happens when there's rain late in the season or wild temperature swings in the summer. And it hasn't happened this bad since the early 80s. Now we're at Genesee, Idaho, at a grain cooperative. Sammy White manages grain coming in and going out for shipping and export. One of the big problems with this low-falling number wheat is testing it quickly. The grain samples are sent to a lab, but the results take days to get back. By then, White says,
we didn't know who had problems, who didn't have problems, so they were all going into these big silos.
Now White has millions of bushels of grain all mixed up, and it will all fetch a lower price. Some may end up as cattle food. White says in a small town, it's just uncomfortable.
Realistically, there probably will be a few guys that will be put out of business because of it. And that's tough.
Up toward Oaksdale, Washington, Larry Brown's plowing up his windblown Palouse Hills.
I've had problems. We've all had problems with falling numbers in the past, but nothing. Nothing this severe and this widespread.
It's already affecting his family. For example, his grandson has bad tires on his pickup.
Normally, I would jump right in and buy him a set of tires, you know. Like I told him, I said, you're going to run them until they run them a little bit longer.
By his count, this year he's 85,000 short of breaking even. So he says it's time to turn the wet earth over. Put this year behind his plow. I'm Anna King, outside of Oaksdale, Washington.
You're with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It's been 50 years since the Black Panther Party was created to fight American inequality. A celebration of that anniversary happened in Oakland last weekend, and a big part of the celebration was Aaron Dixon, the founder and former captain of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panthers. It was the first chapter outside of California, and Dixon started it when he was only 19 years old. He's still proud of the Black Panthers' legacy.
That legacy is international. That legacy is worldwide. You know, they teach about the Black Panther Party in many countries around the world, which is more than I could say for what they do in this country.
What is that legacy?
And that legacy is that people who are oppressed have a right to fight for their freedom, to fight for their justice, and fight for their rights. That's what the legacy of the Black Panther Party is, that all oppressed people, all people who are maligned, who are pushed aside, they all have a right for justice.
What do you think of today's Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, you know, I think, you know, we used to say that that the revolution is a process. You can't go from A to Z. You know, you have to go from A, B, C, D. I think that they, you know, they have a lot to learn. Elaine Brown recently did an interview, and she said that Black Lives Matter has a slave mentality, and I have to agree to that.
What do you mean by that?
That you know, you don't. Anytime you're asking somebody to please don't shoot me, that's a slave mentality. That's what the slaves did. You know, what the Black Panther Party did was we armed ourselves and we taught people that they had a right to defend themselves and protect themselves. We organized the community. We created programs in the community. We got people to understand that they had a right to protect themselves and defend themselves. Because as Huey P. Newton said, the oppressed has no rights that the oppressor is bound to respect.
So instead of hands up, don't shoot, for example, you think modern Black Lives Matter activists should arm themselves and organize more?
No, I don't think they should arm themselves. I think we're in a different time period now, but I think that they need to organize in the community. They need to organize in the community, need to create programs in the community that deal with all of the issues that we have. We have so many issues in our community. You know, Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, the Black Panther Party, we were all about self-determination. We were all about creating our own programs, creating our institutions and owning our institutions in our community and taking control of our community. And that's and nothing has changed. That is still something that we should push for.
So does self-determination, does that run against the idea of coming together and being a melting pot and moving beyond color that we talk about so much?
Well, you know, the whole melting pot, the whole moving beyond color, all you got to do is read the newspaper every day. You know, racism is still alive and well. People should be able to live in their communities without police coming in there and killing them. People should be able to live in their communities and control the school system in their communities. They should have community control of the police. They should have control of the institutions in their community. Every community has a right to their own self-determination. You know, when the Black Panther Party created these coalitions, we weren't talking about a melting pot. We weren't talking about a colorless society, because you can't have a colorless society. Every community has their own culture, has their own cultural value system, has their own way of looking at and dealing with things, and those things should be respected by each community. But we should all be able to come together and address issues that are affecting all of us.
And that situation is no different now, 50 years since the founding of the Black Panthers?
It's worse. In many ways, it's worse.
Why worse? What do you see?
75,000 homeless people in Los Angeles, the second largest homeless encampment in the world. You didn't have that 40 years ago. You got 50,000 homeless people in New York, 20,000 homeless kids in New York. You didn't have that 30, 40 years ago. When you go to Seattle, that has one of the wealthiest cities in the country, and you have 9 homeless encampments. You have 10,000 homeless people in Seattle. You got 2.5 million people in prison. Now you tell me if things are not worse than what they were 40 years ago.
We're talking with Aaron Dixon, former captain of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panthers. What has 8 years of President Barack Obama meant to you?
It's been very disappointing. It's extremely disappointing. But I think what it showed us, doesn't matter what color the person is in the White House, that this system of oppression in America and this imperialist system continues on. And it also shows us that we really do need a third party. This is not a democratic society. We're always talking about regime change and putting in democracy in other countries, but we don't even have a democracy here.
Does it not matter to you whether Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump takes office?
Well, both of those persons are going to be very bad for America and for the world. But right now, the people are not ready to really organize in terms of really creating political change in this country.
What do you think of the protest from the San Francisco quarterback Colin Kaepernick that has somewhat spread?
Well, I think it's beautiful, and I was really glad to see that. And we need more athletes to step up and take a stand. We need more Colin Kaepernicks. We need people like Muhammad Ali and John Carlos and Jim Brown and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, athletes who stood up because they have a lot of power. They have a lot of influence. My hope is that more athletes will begin to professional athletes, not just athletes, but also the entertainers, the people that have the influence, will take a stand against this racism and this supreme capitalism that's taken place that is ruining and destroying our country.
Aaron Dixon, former captain of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panthers Party, the first chapter formed outside of California. He started that when he was 19 years old, and he was part of last weekend's celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Black Panthers. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The first thing you say to somebody whom you've just met, probably a kind of neutral, polite greeting. Hello, I'm so-and-so. What's your name? Sometimes that exchange is more complicated. Radioactive reporter Maya Kahns shares her experience.
It was back in preschool when I shared my mooncakes with my classmates for show and tell to celebrate Chinese New Year. My parents were with me to explain to everyone that I was born in China and was adopted at 10 months old. I remember being very open about my situation when I was younger. But as I got older, I became less open about my adoption. People always pointed out that I looked different from my parents. I hated that. I felt so paranoid, self-conscious, and embarrassed. Thankfully, I had friends like Eileen and Lana, who were also adopted from China, just like me. I looked up to them as if they were my older sisters. But then Eileen moved away. Luckily, Lana still lives near me. Over the years, we talked about how being adopted made us feel, but we never got into as much detail as we did recently.
Okay.
I wanted to know if Lana also got frustrated. We sat on her bed as she shared stories.
You gotta be chill. You can't laugh or I'm gonna...
I told her my story about when I went to D.C. My parents and I were admiring these statues when this old lady came up and handed me a pamphlet that was for foreign exchange students.
Oh my god, that happens? That's never happened to me.
But she did have a similar story, like the time she got her wisdom teeth pulled out. Her dad quietly sat in the waiting room as the dentist, who is also Asian, put his hands in her mouth to get ready for the procedure. And as he leaned over her, he was all like,
"Do you have any Asian blood in you?" And then I was like, "Yeah, probably all of it." And I like definitely had an attitude that day because I was about to get my wisdom teeth pulled and I was already anxious and stuff. And he goes, "So is that your stepdad out there?" And I was like, "No, that's my dad." And, like, really, I wish I could have, you know, like, it could have been enough to just leave it at that. Like, what does this have to do with my teeth, you know? And then he just, like, kept asking me these questions, and I was just in no mood to explain to him my whole background of being adopted. Like, it's really none of his business.
I mean, yeah, that's an awkward conversation, but he may have just been simply wondering. And it's okay to wonder, right? So I asked Lana if there even was an appropriate time for people to ask someone about being adopted.
I mean, there's a time and place for everything and stuff, but I think there's definitely a way that you could have asked. And I'm totally, like, guilty of that, too. Like, if I see two white parents walking with a different raced child, I'd think, like, oh, like, are they adopted? You know, and I will think that, but I would never go up and ask that.
Especially when someone points it out to me, I can then see the distance. Like, I can then see that they see me as not a part of the family.
Like, the disconnect. Yeah. I mean, I get less focused on, like, oh, I look different than my family, because, like, I do look different than my family. Like, I look pretty traditionally South Chinese. But I guess, like, in my head, like, why does it matter? You know, like, it doesn't make me any less theirs.
Then Lana and I talked about that one question that always drives us insane.
So, like, have you met your real family? And that's definitely a pet peeve of mine, because I think in the adopted community, real family isn't a term.
Lana prefers birth family. Then we Googled the definition of family.
Maybe this will help, yeah. Ooh, no.
It read, family is a group of people related to one another by blood or marriage. But neither of us agreed with that.
Because the reality is, like, my family is the one that I live with because I was adopted into this family and I live with them and I love them and, like, we are related, you know, whether or not by blood. And I suppose legally as well.
If you're able to meet your birth people...
You can say birth parents.
I don't know. I don't really like saying birth parents because they aren't...
Because they're not your parents. Yeah, I know. If I was ever given the opportunity to meet my birth parents, like, I don't know if I would do it. What I would probably want is health records.
When she said that, I realized that I wanted my records too. I want to know what I will look like when I'm older. If I have some genetic disease. If I'll live long or die young.
The adopted kids don't have the luxury of doing that. And I mean, the only thing I think about with my kids is that, like, the only health records they have is of me. Like, I'm the only reference they have, and I think that would be frustrating. The thing is, like, it's frustrating for me because I don't even have a generation before me. I have literally what's going on with my body right now.
When she said that about one day having kids, it broke my heart. I got this lump in my throat. It didn't even cross my mind how other people would be affected by this, too. And my own mom and dad. I was so selfish, I never even asked them how they felt about adoption. Were they scared? Did they hold me for the first time and think that I wasn't even their baby?
I started crying. We were actually in a hallway in a hotel with four other families, and the IEs came marching down the hallway with these five little Chinese babies, and we were all meeting our children for the first time, and it was like one big delivery room. Actually, when I first saw you, I just had this feeling like I knew you, like we had known each other for a long time.
And then I saw Beth holding you, and I was filming with the camera, and I wanted to put the camera down and grab both of you and give you big hugs.
And then after I had been holding you for, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes or so, you fell asleep. And when I was holding you, your little hand grabbed on my shirt and just... held on. And I knew it was meant to be.
When my mom said that, I didn't really acknowledge her words. I just sat there speechless. But what I wanted to tell her was that I always knew I was her daughter, and that adoption is just words on paper. It just meant that it took us 10 months to finally meet. For Radioactive, this is Maya Kahns.
Radioactive is KUOW's youth media program. You'll find them on Facebook at Radioactive Youth Media. Thank you for tuning into The Record here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Last Friday, King County Sheriff's deputies shot and killed a pregnant Native American woman. Renee Davis was reportedly suicidal and had a gun. She was home alone with her two children, aged 3 and 2. We know the deputies had come to Davis's home to check on her welfare. We also know the deputies shot and killed Renee Davis and that her death fits into a pattern. Native Americans die at the hands of the police at a disturbingly high rate, higher than even African Americans. Tribes all over Indian country, and especially here in the Northwest, are calling attention to that fact with a movement, Native Lives Matter. Investigative journalist Stephanie Woodard wrote about it in her article titled "The Police Killings No One Is Talking About."
This month has been a very deadly month for Native people. There have been at least 8 deaths so far this month, including Renee's, Seven men were killed. Two were Oglala, Rex Vance Wilson, who was shot in Las Vegas, and Antoine Ladeau, who died in Nebraska. Three Native men appear to have been shot in Oklahoma this month, including one who is so far simply described as a homeless Native American. A Native man from Lumberton, North Carolina, appears to have been shot during the recent hurricane there, and Kiana Little Dog was shot in Midland, Texas. And as far as I can tell, there has been a small amount of local coverage of each of these incidents, but no protests, no national awareness, no big legacy media covering their passing.
Compared to other groups, how likely is it that a Native American will be killed at the hands of police?
They are slightly more likely to be killed than African Americans. I think the ratio is 1.1 to 1. They are 3.1 times more likely to be killed than white people. In the case of Native women, the figures skew much higher. Native women are 2.5 times more likely to be killed than black women. And I think it's 4-point-something times more likely to be killed than white women. That is one thing that is distinctive about this group. Generally speaking, being young and male is a big predictor of getting shot. But in the case of Native people, there are more women involved, and there are more older people, people in their 30s and 40s, who are killed.
We know here in the Northwest about particularly the shooting of John T. Williams, a Native woodcarver. His death in a police shooting sparked reforms of the Seattle Police Department's use of force. There's a second, somewhat less familiar name in the Northwest. Will you tell us the story of Jackie Solliers?
Yes. Jackie Solliers was a 30-some-year-old Puyallup woman. She had four children and was actually pregnant at the time that she was shot. She was sitting in a parked car with her boyfriend, who was wanted on weapons and drug charges. Police drove by, recognized him, and approached them, told them to put their hands up, and so on. Jackie started up the car. Now, the officer who then shot her said that she was driving at him fast and he was standing right in the center of her front bumper. And when you look at the damage to the car, the shots appeared, in fact, to come from alongside the car, and the shooter's partner also placed him along the side of the car toward the front, but not smack dab in the middle of the car. So there was something. It was odd. Things didn't match, and there wasn't video footage. There was a police surveillance camera on the street that malfunctioned during the incident, apparently, and there were some security cameras on the house that it all happened right in front of. The police took the three security cameras and the hard drives to which they were attached as part of their investigation and broke and or lost all of them. So there appears to be some sort of obfuscation or incompetence or something going on in, or a combination of both of those in terms of the investigation. In any case, a young woman is dead, and it creates grief and shock that moves on beyond the incident itself.
What has happened as a result of Jackie Solliers' death?
Well, her family started meeting as a family to try to come to grips with all of this. And gradually, other people from around the area, from Seattle, from where, though there have been police reforms, Shea Taylor was shot fairly recently, people from Seattle, people from Olympia, around the region, came down to Puyallup to join in their meetings. And at the meeting that I attended, there were people there who were Puyallup tribal members, people from other tribes, Latino people, black people, white people, all ages, and all kinds of relationships to the issue. But all of those people were there, and the Puyallups had a traditional talking circle, and everyone went around the circle, and then afterward there was a meal. And a number of the women came up to me afterward and said that they felt safer there on the reservation, surrounded by this family and this tribe and these people than they did elsewhere. And it resonated with the Puyallup's name for themselves, which is in their language, it translates as something like the generous and welcoming people.
You're painting a big picture of, when you talk about Native lives mattering, you lay out a devastating case in your article for how Native lives are not valued, and this goes beyond police killings. Do you see any sign of hope that anything is changing?
This month does not look good. However, I really do think that what's going on in Washington with Proposition 873, with the John T. Williams Initiative...
You're talking about an initiative to make it easier to prosecute police officers,
yes,
in the event.
Exactly.
Of...
What it does is it removes the malice clause from the law. Right now in Washington, in order to prosecute an officer on criminal charges for having contributed to someone's death, you would have to prove that he or she did it with malice. And what attorneys told me is malice is a state of mind, so it's essentially impossible to prove. Now, the removing of the malice exception from the law, would not affect all of the other circumstances described in which police may use force or even lethal force if it is necessary. But it removes that essentially blanket exception. And the Puyallups are not the only people, and the people going to the Puyallup meeting are not the only people involved in gathering signatures. There are many people in Seattle. The NAACP is involved, so there are big organizations. And as a matter of fact, Lisa Hayes, who actually wrote the text of the initiative and is an advocate that's very much involved in this, said that she hopes that through this initiative, this becomes a conversation that is, as she put it, on every porch and at every dinner table. Because we've been talking about proportions here, but there are white people, there are Asian people, there are many people who die either in the initial encounter with the police or in custody right afterward. So all of us need to care.
Investigative journalist Stephanie Woodard. We are tweeting a link to her story, The Police Killings No One Is Talking About. So join us on Twitter at KUOW. This is The Record. I hope you subscribe to this and all KUOW's podcasts on iTunes or KUOW.org, wherever you get your podcasts. And tune in this afternoon. We'll tell you about a ballot initiative that would make it harder to pass ballot initiatives. And the biggest charity in the United States is no longer the United Way. Those stories and much more today on KUOW's All Things Considered.